Get ready to take a flamethrower to the official narrative and learn what the elites don't want you to know. You're listening to the Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Tom Woods Show. This is episode 2535 with John Harris, who is a podcaster and filmmaker. He is the, let's say, I don't know, the, what would you say? The
director, producer.
The director, producer of, in fact, I was just talking to Brian McClanahan about this last week, and he said, I should talk to you. And then I thought, doggone it, he's right. I owe that guy an email. Your film, The 1607 Project, we're all too familiar with the 1619 Project, but the 1607 Project is very important. People should be viewing it. You can view it for free. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2535, as well as below this video. But John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to talking.
All right. So obviously, if there hadn't been a 1619 Project, you probably wouldn't have titled this film in this playful way. But what are you driving at by calling it the 1607 Project?
Well, I'll tell you, this started in late 2020 when the 1776 Commission came out. If you remember that, the Trump administration was responding to the 1619 Project. And basically what they said was that the 1619 Project is wrong because it claims that America's never lived up to the promise of equality. But in fact, we had a civil rights movement. So we did. We have lived up to that. I'm obviously simplifying it. But when I saw their response, I thought, you know, someone's got to give another option here. And there was a 1620 Project that some people were trying to put together. I just noticed a friend of mine actually put this together, but a few months ago, the 1916 Project, and it's like everyone's got a project. But I wanted to take the earlier date, 1607. That's the first permanent English colony in North America. And if we're going to trace the headwaters of America, that's where we should start. These other dates are only dates on the calendar because 1607 happened. So I wanted to obviously respond to the 1619 Project and the success that it had. Brian, I have actually have the book here that Brian put together the book, and he's got Virginia First as the title, Virginia First, the 1607 Project. And so we put that in the documentary as well to give away the fact that we are centering Virginia as the story of America.
I was just saying in the car today with my wife, something that's, I suppose, not super insightful, but we still need to reckon with it. Isn't it something that virtually everybody, when asked about early U.S. history in the colonial period, they think about New Englanders, they think about the little hat, they think about the Pilgrims. That is their first thought. And the Pilgrims date to 1620.
That's
and
right.
Yet Jamestown is founded in 1607. And we just act like it's normal that that's just, I mean, yes, they'll concede that there was a Jamestown. And we were wondering, like, how did this come about? Is it really just a matter of Northern historians are just full of themselves and they emphasized that aspect of the American story? I mean, it's astonishing. Virginia was first, but yet no schoolboy thinks that way outside Virginia and perhaps even inside Virginia.
Yeah, unless you live down the street from Williamsburg, maybe then you would know. But yeah, it is surprising because before the Pilgrims got here, you already had the House of Burgesses set up the year before, 1619. So they had elected representatives. They had democracy, essentially. They had the first Thanksgiving in 1619. This is before the Pilgrims. Again, you have the fact that there's settlements going up all over the place. You have churches. You have a whole society. And the Pilgrims were trying to get to Virginia. They weren't even trying. It was a storm that blew them off course. Or else, I don't know what we would be talking about. The New Englanders would have to come up with another story, I guess. But I do think that the Pilgrim story is an origin story that appeals to modern Americans. And it's not because the Pilgrims directly supported the Proposition Nation. They wouldn't have known what that was. But I think their story somewhat plays into it. And the Puritan city on a hill, that there's this world mission, that you know, the hand of divine providence is leading things towards this culmination. And New England is, they think of themselves in that way. They still think of themselves in that way, even though they've secularized and perhaps some would say paganized. They look at themselves as the organizers and kind of God's gift to mankind. They're globally speaking, they're going to rearrange things and make sure everything operates according to the right principles. And I think that centering it in New England serves that purpose. And that's part of the reason we put out the 1607 Project, is to say that the Proposition Nation is wrong, and that the Puritan origin story, although the Puritans are a significant stream that comes into the United States, it's not the only story, and it's not the most significant story, and it's not the most influential story if you're thinking about early America. Even the first 11 presidents, 7 of them were Virginians. The first Supreme Court Justice, Virginian. The first president under the Articles of Confederation, Peyton Randolph, is a Virginian. The whole thing's Virginian, pretty much, or dominated by Virginia, really up until Lincoln, I would say.
Or even as is said at one point in the film, even when we think about the major people who were debating the nature of the Constitution, for example, well, or at least implicitly debating it, Thomas Jefferson and John Marshall, both sides come out of Virginia.
That's right.
So we have that. I mean, Edmund Randolph, I mean, you could go on and on and on the list of important, influential Virginians. So this isn't even really a Northern and Southern thing. It's a Northern and Virginian thing. I mean, Virginia was so absolutely dominant, played such a critical role in early American history. And early American history would be completely different if Virginian history had been different, if Virginia had been absolutely determined to resist the Constitution, for example. Who knows what American history would have looked like. Now, but going back to the North for a minute, I should point out that I was born in Massachusetts, and I lived there for a long time, and I have a tremendous fondness for it. And I know that, you know, in some abstract sense, I'm not supposed to, because it has bad politics and this and that. But our view is supposed to be there's more to life than politics. And there are a lot of wonderful things about that place that are non-political that I very much miss. But there is something about the legacy of early Massachusetts that persists through to this day, even though superficially you would think, well, certainly there are no church requirements for voting anymore, and they don't have the strange approach to determining church membership that they had in colonial Massachusetts, and they don't have the funny hats and all that. But they do, as you were suggesting, they do still have the idea that they are the light of the world, and the world is full of benighted people who need direction from Massachusetts. I mean, that is in effect how they act. That is how Massachusetts liberals act. And there's a sense in which, for some of them, like John Dewey, progressive John Dewey, you had this sense that John Dewey, he still had a fondness for the church. He just wanted a secular version. Like he loved the church picnic and all the non-religious parts of the church. He'd like that, and the moral superiority and all that. You know, and incidentally, John Dewey would be on the one hand, he couldn't stand dogmatism. That's why he hated the Catholic school system, because the kids are going to be exposed to dogmatism. But geez, American quote-unquote Democrats are some of the most dogmatic people who ever lived.
Yeah, I live actually in New York as I'm talking to you right now in the Hudson Valley region, which if you're from Massachusetts, I don't know if you're familiar or not, but if you go to the end of my road, the Hudson River's right there, so to give you an idea. So we're not far from New England. In fact, some people consider this almost culturally part of New England, even though the Dutch settled here originally. And there are some things that I love about it too, not just the landscape, which is absolutely beautiful, but there is a real tangible heritage. Everyone has one, right? Everyone has architecture and cuisine and music and all of these things. But the thing about New Englanders I've noticed is the way that they look at their heritage or their history, even in general, is almost like they're studying a people group from, you know, somewhere else in the world who spoke a different language. They're so disconnected. And they like to almost assert their superiority over it by categorizing it and trying to understand it from a distance. Whereas in the South, I think when they look at monuments to their forefathers, they're thinking about their forefathers. It's very much a lived reality. It's an organic thing to them. And I wish New England was a little more like that, but I don't know if it's the perfectionistic, more navel-gazing and desire to be imperial across the world. I don't know if it's that, but they do have this tendency to view themselves as with a price tag over their name. They're individuals, and what they've accomplished is their career or how much money they have or something like that, and without a connection as much to others. But then when a virus comes through, of course, they'll all line up right under what the government says. So it's an odd dynamic to think about. And we do go into a little bit of that in the 1607 Project, talking about contrast between Massachusetts or New England and Virginia, but mostly it's a positive piece about Virginia and the South in general. Its cuisine, its music, its religion, its political philosophy, and the way that they did politics. So we want people to walk away understanding more about this other side, because they're probably not going to hear it in the story that is typically told, which is Massachusetts-centric.
Right, and you're right. I mean, I'm emphasizing areas of, let's say, disagreement between Massachusetts Puritans and Virginian Anglicans, because I find that interesting, and especially having come from the North. But it is interesting to note that for all their emphasis on religious orthodoxy in Massachusetts, the long-run legacy of all that is nevertheless Unitarianism and heterodoxy.
That's right.
You know, and I mean, isn't that strange that it should have turned out that way?
Yeah, in Virginia and the South in general, the Bible Belt, we still know it as that, has held on to Christian beliefs far longer. And it's a curious thing, and you wonder why that is. And I mean, everyone has their different views, but in the 1607 Project, we do interview a pastor by the name of Zach Garris, who's written quite a bit on the history of the South. And he's actually from Michigan, so he's not from the South like you are. And he says he thinks that it was this instinct or perfectionistic spirit that people in New England had that ended up overturning their orthodox theology. And so their theology might have said, as Calvinists say, that man is evil and sinful, but they had this tendency to think that they could perfect themselves somehow. And I don't know if you've read Richard Weaver's essay, Two Diarists, where he compares Cotton Mather with William Byrd, a Virginian and a Massachusetts pastor. And he shows that William Byrd may have had his faults, which he did, but he lived life in such a freer and less stressful way than Cotton Mather, who was constantly hoping that he could just do something for God and constantly examining himself and seeing if there was anything, you know, wickedness there, and just obsessed with it. And this is the contention or the idea Zach Garris has, Pastor Zach Garris, that spirit, that navel gazing, eventually overturned their theology, because they really did get the impression you needed to conform. And this outward conformity could overturn original sin. And eventually they dropped their orthodoxy and they adopted a rationalism. That's Unitarianism, essentially, right? It's, let's get rid of the Trinity and some of these things, and we're going to look at religion rationally. And that has led to where they are today, where it's all, I mean, the churches, I was just driving through Massachusetts not long ago, and out in the outlying areas, the churches are either shut down or they're restaurants now, or, I mean, I guess they could have made them temples to reason or something. I don't know if anyone would have gone, but they do have a rich heritage in a way. It's just that they've traded it in for ideology, and the South didn't do that.
And of course, once you do that, then the question becomes, what do we need you for? We already have ideological organizations. We already have social service organizations. What do we need you for? And the inability to come up with a good answer to that question is at the heart of what's going on now.
Mm, profound. Them.
So we've talked about 1607. 1619, we have the House of Burgesses, the first, as you mentioned, the first representative institution in the hemisphere. And of course, we can talk about people of great stature, John Rolfe, John Smith, a good many others. The Constitution, though, it's right from the start, there is a dispute about what it's all about. And we have some people trying to grant more power to the central government. But I can find some Southerners, like James Madison was kind of a tricky guy to keep up with, because sometimes he sounded very, very decentralist, and other times he sounded like a nationalist. So can we really say, is there a Virginian way of looking at the Constitution, or not really?
Yeah. Well, the Abbeville Institute is very much pro-Jeffersonian tradition. And so we do talk about James Madison, and especially when it comes to, because he supported the Bill of Religious Freedom. And we talk about Patrick Henry, who is against that. I mean, you can find Virginians who are arguing different sides of a lot of these issues, but primarily Thomas Jefferson kind of takes center stage. He's the second president from Virginia, and obviously significant for writing the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Religious Freedom. And I mean, when it comes to education in America, he's really the preeminent figure even of that, with the University of Virginia. And we don't say that there's one singular Virginia political tradition, But there is a dominant political tradition that not only existed in Virginia, but eventually came to dominate the South. And I would say, I think beyond the South, I think now in many parts of rural America, in the Midwest, you see this decentralized tradition, this desire to favor the local over the center. And in New England, you certainly have, if there is a New England tradition, it is the centralization tendency. And Virginia eventually did stand against that. And so we do get into, we mentioned the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, but we also talk about the Civil War and the significance of that event. And I said I was going to mention a story about you because I thought it would be fun for the program. But the first time I actually ever saw you in person, I believe it was Harvard. No, it was Yale. Sorry. It was Yale about 15, I don't know when I want to say 15 years ago because it makes me feel old myself, but it was a while ago where you debated secession. You remember that?
That the Yale Political Union, yes.
And you
and I
won.
I ended up carrying that resolution.
You did. And I was in the audience with my hand up to support you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I wasn't a student. I drove from the Hudson Valley to be there that night. And I just thought that this is incredible that I was expecting you were going to be protested and you were going to lose the vote and you carried it. And I think that that is one of the significant things about the Virginia and then the Southern political tradition that today we're seeing people who might not even know that this is where it comes from, but they are starting to say, you know what, it makes sense to let California be California and let Alabama be Alabama. And if nothing else comes through our documentary, we really want people to understand that and support federalism.
I can't remember who it was who says it, but somebody says something along the lines of, look, coming out of the Virginia tradition, there is not really an instinct that says we want to make San Francisco like Virginia, but there absolutely 100% is an instinct coming out of San Francisco that we want to make Virginia like San Francisco. We can't leave well enough alone because we need to spread our ideas to everybody to liberate them from their stupid opinions they hold.
That was Barry Shane. And he, I think in that context, he was talking about Jerry Falwell and that Jerry Falwell used to say this. That
And isn't that the opposite of what you would think? Like Jerry Falwell is supposed to be the dumb, backward, bigoted guy who wants to impose his ideas everywhere. And it just goes to show if you're getting your understanding of life from CNN or anything even remotely attached to it, you are almost certainly going to be understanding the exact opposite of what's really happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Jerry Falwell saying that and thinking along the lines of the religious right, Pat Robertson also being from Virginia, these guys, when they're reinterpreted today by CNN, they are looked upon as theocrats who want to force their opinions on everyone in the country so that they conform to some kind of a Christian law. When you actually examine what they said and what they were trying to do, it seems like they were trying to protect themselves, traditional communities, and both of them being from Virginia, I can't help but think maybe there's something in the water there. They were trying to protect Virginia from the forces emanating from these major urban areas over the media and pop culture. And I think time has shown them probably to be more right than wrong on some of these things. They were tapping into something. They could see where things were going.
Yeah, no question about that. Folks, people throw the word intolerant around, but I'll tell you what I'm intolerant of. Fluff. Fluff in the books I read. I'm a pretty productive guy, and a big part of why I get so much done is precisely that I am so impatient with fluff in all areas of my life. Just get to the point. And sometimes you need to say that to books. Just tell me what you need to tell me. And that's exactly what the Blinkist app does for thousands of nonfiction books in 27 different categories. No fluff, just the heart of the matter. You can absorb the Blinkist summary of a book in just 15 minutes of reading or listening. What a time to be alive. Among the thousands and thousands of titles at Blinkist, remember you will also find libertarian classics from Milton Friedman, from Murray Rothbard, and yes, indeed, even a volume by old Tom Woods here. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 40% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to get 40% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get two premium subscriptions for the price of one. Let's go back, though, to something you said toward the beginning. You used the expression, the proposition nation. Now, I talked to Brian about this last week, but the proposition nation is a very, very widespread view that is held and defended, certainly by everybody on the left and by three quarters of what passes for the right. So I think it, you know, it bears repeating. What is that idea and what's wrong with it?
So the proposition nation is the notion that America is an idea. And we open up the 1607 Project documentary with a sequence that's about a minute and a half of all these celebrities and mostly politicians. I think we have every president for the last 40 years from Reagan on saying essentially that America is an idea. We have Paul Ryan saying it, and then, of course, culminating in the 1619 Project, and they say America is an idea. And what they mean by that, depending on who's saying it, is that America is either reducible to a notion of equality or freedom or liberty or some mix of these things. And it's very nebulous, and I think it serves a convenient purpose for politicians who want to tie this to their policies. So if you want to invade Iraq, then you say it's for the proposition of freedom. And we can build America over there, essentially. If you want to forward the LGBTQ agenda, you can say the same thing. If you want to protect, supposedly, your region from a virus, you can also say, frame it in terms of this is about equality and access to healthcare. And when you do that, it's powerful because if you oppose the policy prescription, you're really not an American anymore. Because that's what they're saying is that if America is about equality and this policy is about equality and you don't like the policy, well, you must not really be an American. And so this has been weaponized. And unfortunately for our side, if you want to call it our side, through, you know, the right more broadly, this has become, I think you're being generous when you say, or maybe underplaying it rather, when you say three quarters. I think it feels to me sometimes like it's everyone. It's like 90% of the right seems to agree with the proposition nation, although there is a populist streak that seems to be kicking back against that. As J.D. Vance just said, it's not only an idea, it's also a people in his inauguration acceptance speech. But we get into that. We get into, you know, we talk about the Puritans and so forth and this world mission, but then we talk about Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address, where we really see, I think, the first popular example of the proposition nation being used to forward certain ends. And then we jump to Harry Jaffa, who is a, I guess, political theorist who worked under or studied under Leo Strauss. And he, I think, is probably more responsible than anyone else for getting this idea into right-leaning institutions and figures. People like Dinesh D'Souza, Larry Arnn, Claremont Institute, Michael Anton. And they start parroting this kind of thing, and you hear it come up every so often. And so we argue against it. We say it's ahistorical and it's also damaging.
What do you want people to walk away from watching this thinking? How do you want their outlook changed, let's say?
Well, if they're someone who's, I think our typical person who's maybe not already with us on some of these issues is a right-leaning, let's say, evangelical Christian. And they've just adopted whatever talk radio is telling them on politics and history, and maybe they went to public school. When they're watching it, I hope what they see is that many of the things that they were told aren't accurate. The country didn't start with the Pilgrims. It didn't start in 1776, or at least what led to the country. Our society started with Virginians in 1607, who made many contributions. And these contributions are real and tangible. And so the second thing I hope that they would notice is that the things that really confer identity, and you hit on this earlier, aren't just political positions or party affiliation. They're things like cuisine and music and, you know, our military tradition and our sense of honor and hierarchy and the way we talk and greet each other and interact with each other. And all of these things are important for people to tap back into, to remember them, to, insofar as they can, practice the true and valuable and positive things from our past. Because without those things, we don't know who we are. We're just unmoored. We'd have no place of belonging. So that would be the second thing. I really want people to have a sense of identity that comes from, that they can draw from this. And maybe that sets them down other paths to explore figures that they were attracted to. Maybe Robert Hunt or Robert E. Lee or Lewis and Clark, the first really major explorers who were Virginians who explored the West and the bravery they had. And then third, I would say, and this is for me, I mean, I'm an evangelical Christian. I believe that really, ultimately, there's no saving America without Christianity. Christianity was intrinsic to the founding of America. And so we do focus quite a bit on the early American religion, which is Christianity, and the impact that made and the importance of it. And so I hope people are curious about that, especially those on the right who might not have a Christian background, or maybe they're nominally Christian. They might be more serious about it.
All right. Well, how about the subject of slavery? It's absolutely unavoidable when talking about anything having to do with the South. It's always slavery and race. So do you have anything interesting to say about those subjects that hasn't been said before?
Well, I hope I don't have anything that hasn't been said before, because I hopefully we take the best of what has been said. So we do focus on some of the positive contributions of slaves in the 1607 Project. We talk about the Christianization of slaves who came from Africa. They weren't Christians over there, but they became Christians, many of them, when they came to the New World. We talk about contributions like barbecue, which we have a chef from the Culinary Institute who's been on Chopped, and he's one Iron Chef, and so he's very accomplished. But he talks about how in the early Southern America or early South, barbecue essentially originated because the cuts of meat the masters didn't want to eat, the slaves would eat, but they were so tough, and so they figured out this way of making them more tender. And so we go through some of those things, and I think it's important to include that in our story. But we also don't buy into the guilt narrative. And so we do talk about how Virginia was the first to attempt to outlaw the slave trade, that the South, they weren't these cartoon characters that we often think of, where they just wanted to perpetuate slavery forever, and they just like slavery. I mean, to have a more balanced perspective, New England merchants were primarily the ones bringing them over and making money off the trade. And those in the South who were involved in it, who were really the minority of Southerners, but they were the upper class, many of them treated their slaves very charitably. They had biblical instructions in how to do this. And a lot of them were progressive emancipationists. And so Sandy Mitchum in the documentary talks about this a bit. There were a lot of anti-slavery societies in the 1830s until the abolitionists gained traction, and they didn't want slaves being freed they want emancipation without compensation and integration. And so without compensation and integration, the South didn't have a way forward. The slaves were just going to be bottled up in the South. And this was a bad arrangement. And I think race relations are poisoned today, partially because the radical abolitionists got their way in a lot of things. And the slaves were freed in a war-torn region. And a lot of them starved, died, and were used as political pawns. And it's a sad story. And so that's part of our story as well. We don't really go to talk about that in depth, the Reconstruction era in the documentary, but we do talk about slavery. We do talk about its importance, and also the importance of not being guilty about it, because this has happened in every country in the ancient world up through just before the modern era. And it's something that every other country was pretty much able to end without a war except us. And so the South really isn't at fault for how things turned out in every way. In fact, the North bears a lot of the responsibility for that as well.
It is worth noting, because so few people are aware of it, that as you say, there were about 1,000 anti-slavery societies in the South before the politics became so polarizing that it became an absolute non-starter to be part of such an organization, and all of them disappeared. So I'm always interested in finding out if somebody turns out to be a bad guy, I'm happy to know that. If somebody turns out to be partly good, partly bad, I'm happy to know that. I just find that in general, we so often seem to prefer cartoonish versions of things, where there's a cartoon villain and a cartoon rescuer. And it's not satisfying, because we know that the world is rather different than that, let's say.
Yeah, it's more complicated. And many Southerners, when they inherited this institution, I think it's important for people to remember, there wasn't a modern state there to say, hey, don't bring those slaves here. You had indentured servants here. There were even some white slaves. I know that's controversial, but I lived in Lynchburg, and we had an old house near us, and the records of the house talked about these white slaves. I mean, there were a few, and there were black slave masters. So it's not quite as simple. But I think the important takeaway is that the moral will to end slavery was in the South. Virginia did have it, and we show that Virginia did have this, and there were external things that prevented them from taking that course. from the Revolution really onward, there was always an attempt to limit, to end. I mean, the Confederate Constitution even outlaws the foreign slave trade. So there were these attempts being made, and I don't think the South gets any credit for that.
You know, we specialize in forbidden history here on the Tom Woods Show, and that's why I am sure you are going to want to watch Lincoln's Quest for Empire, a brand new forbidden documentary. Discover the shocking truths buried within America's untold history in this groundbreaking documentary. It features stunning visuals and expert analyses and reveals the war's pivotal role in American history. Dr. Clyde Wilson, a personal friend of mine whom Eugene Genovese called one of the top 10 Southern historians in America, had this to say: "It is the origin of everything that troubles so many of us in America today. You'll never find a superior presentation in word and picture of what happened in those years. Learn the fate of the Puritan faith in the North and the rise of Northern heretical movements. Watch Lincoln's destruction of Southern churches. Hear of the Northern Army's rape of Athens, Alabama, and its slaves. Discover the real purpose of his Emancipation Proclamation. And finally, the forgotten 1 million freedmen who died or became critically ill from starvation, neglect, and epidemics." That's questforempire.com. Kevin Gutzman tells me there's a forthcoming book specifically on Jefferson and slavery. And that's going to be most welcome because most people just think, well, Jefferson was just a flat-out hypocrite. And they don't know any of the details here. There's a much, much more interesting and complicated story. I did an episode of the Tom Woods Show on that. I'll link to that in the notes for this one. What are you particularly, if you had to identify one or two things, what are you particularly proud of or pleased with about this project?
Oh, there's so many things. I didn't expect it to happen. You have an idea, right? And you don't always know, is this actually going to manifest itself in something? And so I sent out an email and Clyde Wilson and Brian McClanahan and a few others. And I didn't even know if it was a good idea. I just thought there needs to be something. And they ended up thinking it was a good idea. And I've enjoyed watching this come to fruition and seeing a book and also a documentary. And I wouldn't really change anything. It tells you exactly what America's like. I love that. If I had to pick one thing, and it's hard to pick, but I think the bit on Southern music is particularly interesting because I'm used to political documentaries, which talk about what the intrigue in the White House and what was happening and who was saying what. And that is interesting. But cultural things in those documentaries, you know, you're not going to see cultural things. And this has all of it. And music, I love music. So I'm a guitarist. I lead music at my church. I used to do the rock band, garage band thing, right, when I was younger. And one of the things I did not know before getting into this is that Southern music is pretty much American music. Like, they're one and the same. And when Europeans or people from other places, they think of America, they primarily think of the South. But one of the reasons is because of our music and our pop culture. And whether it's 12-bar blues or Scottish snaps, these are all things that came in through Virginia. And as Virginians interacted with the native populations and interacted with slaves, they came up with these fascinating new sounds. Eventually, we call some of them rock and roll, right? We have names for these different genres, and they all pretty much trace back to Jamestown in some way. And New England doesn't have this. They don't have any original musical genres that are unique to them. And I thought that was a huge contrast. So that's one of the things I guess I would point out that I think is fascinating. Tom Daniel works with Brian McClanahan, actually, was the one who I interviewed for the music part.
Tell me again where you're from.
I live in New York, so it's a complicated question to ask where I'm from, though. I was born in California. My parents are Californian. My Southern connection is my grandfather's from Mississippi. So he had like 9 siblings. So every summer we would pack up the car, go down to Mississippi for family reunions. And that's where my love for the South was born.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you attribute it to that? Or is it some kind of intellectual enlightenment that you had on the subject in the ensuing years?
Well, I did go to an Abbeville Institute summer conference in 2017. And that was the first time I had read Mel Bradford and Richard Weaver and some of these other guys. I think I went home and I read I'll Take My Stand. And so I started getting into that a little more and I found it rich. Before that, I would listen to talk radio and I knew kind of your basic neoconservatism. And I was always feeling like that lacked somewhere, like it wasn't fulfilling. Like there was some missing story. I could argue free market economics, but it didn't really drive me. I just felt like I was doing a math equation. And when I started realizing, I guess, more who I was, my own identity, my own connection to the South, but also to just early America in general. I have an uncle who's really into genealogies. And so I have ancestors who came in through Jamestown, through Harrisburg, set up Harrisburg. I have ancestors on even the Mayflower and stuff. So I started getting interested in all of this stuff. And the South has always intrigued me because for all its faults, and every people has their faults, I think that there is a friendliness and there's a neighborliness and just a sense of caring and belonging that just does not exist in the North. It's just much more cold in the North, figuratively and literally. And I remember growing up, you know, my first jobs and everything, I'm working with guys who sometimes don't always have the most racially sensitive views, but they always thought the South was always worse. The South was horrible. It's just, even my own wife, I married a girl locally here. She thought because we moved to North Carolina, Virginia for school, and we lived there for 4 years, she thought it's just going to be a lot of racism when we go down there. And I knew that wasn't true. I just knew that that was a lie from all my experience, that my own family had better relationships with their neighbors who were of a different skin color than I saw and witnessed in the North, where people hardly say hi to you. So that's a long answer. I know you probably weren't expecting all that, but I see some true and valuable things that I'm afraid we're losing. And I think the South has retained them for longer, and I want to reinforce those things. And that's part of the reason we did 1607 Project.
I think there are reasons that the South is demonized and that it's not entirely for the reasons that we are officially given. So yes, of course, the reason that we are officially given is that it's a racist and intolerant place and so on. And the thing is, I can find plenty of that in the North, plenty of it all through American history. I think there's even a point in Amistad where it's a Connecticut courtroom, and there are black people sitting there listening to the proceedings. No black person would have been allowed in a courtroom in antebellum Connecticut. I mean, you know, and yet no one even bothered to point that out because no one's ever thought of that because they've already got their version of things lined up. But I think the real reason is threefold or morefold. Traditionally, now, especially if you read books like the ones you mentioned, I'll Take My Stand by the 12 Southerners from around 1930. Also, Richard Weaver, there's a collection that Liberty Fund put out called The Southern Essays of Richard M. Weaver that make very interesting reading. If you read some of these books, what do you find about Southern civilization? That it doesn't make progress an idol, that the newer is always better than the older. There's a respect for the past there, and there is more of a commitment to religious orthodoxy. Now, let's say you were trying to carry out a social revolution in the country. What would annoy you the most? Well, a refusal to embrace novelty, a respect for the past, and a lingering connection to religious orthodoxy. So the South fits the profile perfectly of the villain of the story of the revolution. And by the revolution, I mean the unfolding of the left's destiny in the course of implementing progressivism. The South is the boogeyman because it holds all the views that tend to block the unfolding of that thing. That's my theory.
I think that's excellent. And maybe this is included in it, but I would add a respect for hierarchy might be a fourth thing. I don't know. But yeah, I completely concur with what you just said.
Well, so now the question is, who is the natural audience for this? Do you want educators to use it? Do you just want conservatives to watch it? I mean, obviously, anytime you write a book or you make a movie, the answer is, well, everyone should. I know that. But
yeah.
I'd like everyone to read my books, but I funnel them to particular people who are most likely to read them. But yeah, sure, I'd love them to be used in a classroom. I'd love to have materials available to help it be used in the classroom. What's your goal here, other than the perfectly understandable intellectual satisfaction of simply having done it?
Yes, which is satisfying. But I think that those who are especially homeschoolers and on the right more broadly, but maybe they haven't worked all these things out, they need to be exposed to this. My audience and my podcast audience is, I'd say, mostly composed of Orthodox Christian, small o, because it's cross-denominationally, but they don't like the woke agenda coming into their church. But I don't think most of them, or many of them, I should say, have probably thought through in detail what the counterbalance to that is. I think they operate on a default kind of boomer con, and I don't want to say my whole audience at all, but I think many of them, that's just where they were raised in. They had sort of liberal tendencies, thinking that the multicultural society works. You know, all these catchphrases that, I don't know if you heard them when you were a kid, but I heard them, that you can be anything you want to be, that diversity is our strength, my body, my choice, all of these things. It captivates the left and the right. And so I want the right to be broken free from some of these things. And I think one of the ways to do that is to give them some tangible background into what America is, that it's not ideologically driven, because that's what they're used to, is so much ideology. So I did suggest at the outset that it would be great to have a homeschool curriculum, or even a curriculum you could use maybe in Christian schools or private schools. And if the resources are there, we will do it eventually. My understanding is the resources aren't there at this point, but this is something that I'm still open to. And in fact, I emailed someone last week about it, seeing if they could maybe help put something like that together. So even if we don't have an accompanying, you know, quiz or test book, you can still do the documentary. You can still use the book for high schoolers and talk through it in like a homeschool setting.
Well, I'm going to, of course, as I say, link to the video in the description, as well as at tomwoods.com/2535. It's Virginia First, the 1607 Project, and it features people you will perhaps have seen on the Tom Woods Show. And it's very well done, and it very much needs to be done, because the story of America is told all wrong, at least in the popular telling. If you ask a typical schoolboy, tell me the history of America, he'll start with the Pilgrims. he's just going to start with the Pilgrims. And it's not just that they overlook Jamestown, although that is irritating and weird, but there is a kind of bias, I think, through a U.S. history, like that it was the North's destiny to be the dominant force and to lead the world this way and that. I don't know. I think some of the world is probably tired of this attitude that comes, I wouldn't say entirely from the North, but there's definitely a big, big strain of it running through the history of the North and the way some of those folks thought. And I say that as a child of the North who loves it dearly. But all the same, John Harris, thanks so much for your time and for your work on this important project.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
And everybody, before we go, I want to remind you, I am taking to the water for the first time in 6 years with the Tom Woods Cruise. It will be the best time you can possibly imagine. If you missed the Contra Cruises of the late teens and you thought, oh, well, they'll do another one of these and I'll be able to go then. And then you found out that there weren't any more. Here's your chance. Head over to tomwoodscruise.com and I'll see you, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow.
Make yourself and those you love less vulnerable to the regime, both mentally and physically. Get more forbidden information at tomsfreebooks.com and be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen. See you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.